Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi says Tehran does not intend to leave talks on the revival of the JCPOA, but won't back down from its stance in the negotiations. Meanwhile, Iran's top security official says his country will continue remedial measures in the nuclear sector as long as the West's illegal practices are not changed. Also, the U.S. president signs into law the first major federal gun reform in decades, just weeks after mass shootings in Uvalde and Buffalo killed more than 30 people. Iran's president has slammed a recent anti-Tehran resolution by the IAEA's Board of Governors, saying the measure will not force the Islamic Republic to back down from its stance in the Vienna talks.
Negotiations will continue. We don't want to stop the talks, but we have said many times that this resolution cannot force us to back down from a stance. Our negotiators will engage in dignified negotiations to restore the rights of the Iranian people. This has been stressed in meetings with European Union's foreign policy chief, Josep Borrell.
In a televised interview, Raisi said the improper resolution was put forward while Iran was in the middle of the JCPOA revival talks and was cooperating fully with the International Atomic Energy Agency. His remarks came shortly after Iran's foreign minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian and EU foreign policy chief Josep Borrell met in Tehran and announced talks on reviving the 2015 deal will resume in the coming days. Borrell also met the secretary of Iran's Supreme National Security Council. Ali Shamkhani told him Iran's remedial measures in the nuclear sector are a legal and rational response to U.S. unilateralism and Europe's inaction. He added Tehran will continue to the measures as long as the West's illegal practices are not changed.
It takes an in-person visit to Iran by the EU foreign policy chief now to revitalize the ailing 2015 deal between Iran and world powers. Josep Borrell said his two-day trip to Tehran is aimed at removing the last remaining roadblocks to concluding the Vienna talks, which have been at a stalemate since March this year.
My visit has one main objective. It was to break the current dynamic of escalation and to break the stalemate of the negotiations on the JCPOA.
The talks in Vienna began in April last year with the aim of returning the United States to the 2015 deal and ensuring Tehran's full compliance with its commitments. The negotiations have been stalled since March amid differences between Tehran and Washington. Iran says the United States, which is not directly engaged in the talks, must remove all its anti-Iran sanctions before Tehran returns to its full compliance with the accord.
We hope that the Americans will this time be realistic and act responsibly on the path toward achieving an agreement.
Borrell says it's in no one's interest that the pause in the talks persists, urging Tehran and Washington to resume the talks as soon as possible.
There are decisions that have to be taken in Tehran and in Washington. But we agree today that this visit will be followed by the resumption of negotiations also between Iran and U.S., facilitated by my team to try to solve the last outstanding issues.
Iran welcomed Borrell's call. Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian says his country is ready to resume the talks within the next few days.
First of all, Iran is ready to get back to the talks in the coming days. Secondly, what is important for the Islamic Republic is that Iran should enjoy the economic benefits promised under the agreement that was signed in 2015.
Iran started to scale back its obligations to the 2015 deal following Washington's unilateral withdrawal from the accord in 2018 and its ensuing imposition of sanctions on Iran. That triggered a series of talks between Iran and the remaining parties to the deal in Vienna to salvage the accord.
The Vienna discussions have for months been in limbo as a result of serious demands that neither sides of the bargain are willing to give up on. However, Borrell sees a glimmer of hope at the end of the tunnel, promising to help Tehran and Washington sort out the last remaining issues when the talks will resume in the upcoming days. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Professor at the University of Tehran, Fuadi Zadi, explains Washington's role in the deadlock in the talks aimed at reviving the 2015 deal. Have a listen.
Mr. Burra said there is a deadlock in the talks, and the problem that exists is in Washington. In the U.S. Congress, people, senators, powerful people, oppose U.S. returning to JCPOA. They say this very clearly, both Republicans and Democrats. Robert Menendez, who is the chair of Senate Foreign Affairs Committee, said this in public about 2 weeks ago when he was talking to Robert Malley as the witness that the Senate had invited. So with this chaos in Washington, the opposition to JCPOA is quite severe. There's a lot of politics going on. And if the American officials were honest, they would say that we have internal divisions. We cannot return to JCPOA, and that's going to be a true statement. In reality, that's not what they're saying. They're engaging in this type of blame game. They want to blame Iran for talks not succeeding.
U.S. President Joe Biden has signed into law the first major federal gun reform in the country in three decades. The House of Representatives had passed the bipartisan bill on Friday following Senate approval. The legislation includes provisions to help states keep guns out of the hands of those deemed to be a danger to themselves or others. It, however, falls short of more restrictive gun control proposals that Democrats favor. The signing of the bill comes just weeks after mass shootings in the U.S. cities of Uvalde and Buffalo that killed more than 30 people, including 19 children, at an elementary school. We've asked our correspondent Colin Campbell to explain the bill and restrictions it stipulates. Here's what he had to say.
The bill that President Biden signed calls for tougher background checks, especially for younger gun buyers, those younger than 21. It would provide another layer of security or protection, they say, for someone to buying a gun. What they wanted to prevent here were people who were younger, who would buy a gun in a fit of an emotional state, like what seemed to have happened in Uvalde, where the gun was able to be purchased very quickly and then able to be used in a feeling of whatever emotion the shooter at that time was feeling. And they've seen other cases of this where people have been able to buy guns. I believe also this happened in Oklahoma as well with the shooting there. A man was in pain, back pain, and shot his doctor. And so they're looking at that case and many others that came up with that policy. And then you have what are called red flag laws. These are people who have had a background or a history of some type of mentally compromised action or expression being restricted from buying a gun or anything physical, domestic violence, so on and so forth. So people who may have had a history of violence or reasons why for them to own a gun would be somewhat questionable, those are also in place.
Fears that Russia-Ukraine war can lead to a water conflict are growing as tensions keep escalating between Moscow and Kiev's Western supporters. In the latest development, NATO countries have taken more measures against Russia in response to its move to cut off gas. That has raised concerns that the Ukraine war can easily turn into a direct confrontation between Russia and the West.
Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov says the European Union and NATO are gathering a coalition for war with Moscow. This after the EU unanimously granted candidacy status to Ukraine and Moldova. Lavrov drew parallels between current-day events and those of the first half of the 20th century when Germany was preparing an attack on the Soviet Union.
When the Second World War was about to start, Hitler gathered most of the European countries under his banners. Now the EU and NATO are also gathering the same modern coalition for the fight, and by and large for war with the Russian Federation. We will look at this very carefully.
Lavrov's remarks came after the EU leaders stepped up rhetoric against Russia.
EU's decision strengthens Ukraine and Moldova in the face of Russian aggression.
A confrontation between Moscow and NATO's nuclear armed members would have catastrophic consequences for Europe. After all, Europe would be the immediate theater of such a war.
In terms of the possibilities of war, NATO fighting a war with Russia, I don't think they are very good. First of all, because the United States will not suffer as a result of this war. The Europeans will suffer. The Europeans, if they start down this path, they will unleash a nuclear war, in which case their entire, all of the NATO countries will be destroyed, all of the NATO bases. It will be a catastrophe for these people. And I think the leaders of the three major countries, Germany, France, and Italy, I think they understand this. And I think that's why they have been going to Kiev to have discussions with President Zelensky. They know that the people, this is not in their interest.
Candidate status is only the first step on the path to EU membership, which can take decades. But putting the EU action in the context of the current state of affairs, we can see that the rising escalation might quickly lead to catastrophic consequences.
Tensions have been escalating between the West and Russia over a number of issues. Russia is strongly opposed to the West's military support for Ukraine and has already warned of serious consequences. And now, Moscow is outraged at the EU for what it calls blockading Kaliningrad, a Russian exclave in the Baltic.
Tensions are also increasing between the EU and Russia over the growing Kaliningrad crisis. This after Lithuania began enforcing the EU sanctions and restricted the transit of goods to Kaliningrad. Moscow says the move amounts to a blockade of its exclave and has warned of serious consequences.
As for retaliatory measures and what they will be like, will they be exclusively in the diplomatic dimension? The answer is no. They will not be in the diplomatic dimension. They will be practical.
A move by Russia on Lithuania would clearly trigger NATO's Article 5 mutual defense provision, immediately pulling in all the alliance's members to a potential nuclear war with Russia. But how far can the Europeans really push for such an escalatory path with Russia, especially at a time when they are experiencing an energy crisis?
If you're asking me personally, I personally think that the main reason for the war in the Ukraine was to block the alliance between Germany and Russia. And the symbol of that alliance was the Nord Stream 2 pipeline, which never got opened. As a result, now Germany is in a critical crisis because Russia has control of its energy. Russia just dialed down 40% of its energy. Germany cannot survive under these conditions. It is not in Germany's interest to commit suicide for the United States of America.
On Thursday, Ukraine said it had received U.S. supplies of high-mobility artillery rocket systems, a powerful long-range weapon system that Kiev hopes can help turn the tide on Russia's military offensive. Russian officials have repeatedly warned that the U.S. decision to supply Ukraine with advanced rocket systems could exacerbate the conflict.
Protests and strikes continue in Italy as the country is suffering from sharply rising energy costs and growing inflation. Movements and associations representing different layers of society have been staging protests for months, demanding support to the government. Max Civili reports from Rome.
As Italy's socioeconomic conditions worsen by the day, the country is witnessing an endless number of protests and strikes. On Friday, the Italian Association of Private Construction and Building Technicians staged a protest against the government's decision to suspend the so-called Superbonus scheme. The measure, which granted homeowners access to a tax credit of up to 110% on the cost of upgrading their home, was introduced in 2020 in an attempt to counter the nefarious effects on the economy of the COVID crisis.
This bonus was a real blessing for us. Finally, after decades, we stopped lowering our bids. But suddenly, not only the price of building materials sharply increased, but also the government stopped funding the scheme under the pretext that some companies were cheating. È una
vergogna. The government should be ashamed. Building companies are going bankrupt. 200,000 workers will soon lose their job. We are furious.
Meanwhile, taxi drivers across Italy have staged the umpteenth strike action, disrupting traffic in several cities. Taxi drivers are on the warpath with the government over an EU directive which aims at liberalizing the sector. The National Bureau of Statistics, Istat, has said household consumer confidence has plummeted in June amidst great preoccupation for energy rising costs and for the ramifications of the Ukraine crisis. Quite surprisingly, consumer confidence is up for the second consecutive month. Also on Friday, USB-based union staged a protest at the Ministry of Economic Development against, quote, Italy's unsustainable precarization of work. USB says young Italians are only offered temporary, badly paid jobs.
Salaries in Italy haven't grown for over 30 years. Nevertheless, military spending is on the rise. Ours is the EU country with the highest number of contracts regulating badly paid casual work.
Italians are also very worried about the water drought that has afflicted the country over the past weeks. Several regions are mulling over introducing water rationing to manage the limitation of water. The Lombardy region on Friday declared a state of emergency for drought after water levels in the Po River fell by over three quarters amid the worst drought in 70 years. Max Civili, Rome.
This is IRIB English Radio. With you early in the morning. With you at midday. With you till the night's end. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Gun supporters and expedient politicians who take firearms industry and other military-industrial complex big donor money while expressing heartfelt prayers are disingenuous, disgusting, and deserving of maximum shame, says F. Douglas Stephenson, researcher, in an article published under the heading Gun Maker Profits Soar as Bloody Massacres Proliferate in the U.S. Stay tuned for more. U.S. citizens are waking up to the fact that so many politicians can be so easily bought by the weapons industry, an industry that doesn't care how many people must die to protect their huge profits. SafeHome.org reports that after a record year in 2020, gun sales in the U.S. dipped slightly in 2021. Still, with nearly 19 million guns sold, 2021 was the second highest year for gun sales in the U.S., behind only 2020, when estimated gun sales topped 21 million. The previous record year was 2016, with about 16 million guns sold. Total estimated gun sales fell 13% between 2020 and 2021, but they remained higher than they were in 2019, up nearly 40%. The large number of weapons in the United States of America is not only highly profitable for the weapons industry, but also further supports the myth that guns are necessary to maintain the image of rugged individualism. The total number of guns sold in 2021 is more than double the number sold in 2001. In fact, sales in the U.S. rose by about 155% between 2002 and 2021. No state had more gun sales in 2021 than Texas, where an estimated 1.6 million firearms were sold in the nation's second largest state. Florida followed closely with 1.4 million firearms sold. DearLord.com reported that weapons makers Roger and Winchester both had profit spikes in recent earnings filings. Their latest 2021 quarters topped record sales the companies had experienced even during the height of 2020 gun sales surge. The numbers come after July 2021 came in as the second best July on record for FBI background checks on gun sales. Roger reported its net sales in the first 6 months of 2021 were up over $130 million or 51% over the same time last year. The company did nearly $200 million in firearm sales alone between April and June. That represents a 54% increase over the same period in 2020, even though the onset of the coronavirus pandemic and rioting drove Americans to gun stores at record rates during that time period. Similarly, Winchester reported the first 6 months of 2021 produced a $412 million or 108% increase in sales. The gun and ammo maker's sales increased even further by 110% when looking at the April to June period. Winchester's parent company, Olin Corporation, saw net income climb from a $120 million loss in the April to June period of 2020 to a $355 million profit in 2021. They went from a $220 million loss in the January to June 2020 period to a $599 million profit in 2021. In spite of the above numbers, many citizens are also realizing that the idea of the Second Amendment guaranteeing the right of individual gun ownership is radical and wrong, and was never intended by the founders to be a barrier to establishing a stringent weapon safety and control laws for the U.S. community. Turning gun violence into a mental health problem is incorrect, dangerous, and irresponsible, as anyone with even minimal knowledge of mental health issues knows. It's of course true people who kill children en masse are crazy, but asserting this reality says nothing. All countries have mentally ill and violent people, but U.S. citizens are increasingly more aware that only the United States of America arms them. Although the U.S. public is demanding real changes for much better safety and weapons regulation, the toxic results of U.S. current lack of adequate weapons control policies continues its deadly pace. The United States of America cannot any longer allow the profiteering military-industrial complex and their beholden politicians to get away with hiding or changing the subject, hoping the public forgets about the problem until the next mass shooting. By using denial over many years to reject and avoid the need for stringent gun control legislation, the GOP and some Democrats have fallen into a miasma of self-induced indifference and dangerous permissiveness toward gun ownership and its deadly consequences. The large number of weapons in the U.S. is not only highly profitable for the weapons industry, but also further supports the myth that guns are necessary to maintain the image of rugged individualism. This is why resistance to legislative proposals to better gun control culture and gun violence itself seem to many gun owners as attacks on their own personality and national identity. The bigger, more powerful the weapon, the more powerful the gun owner feels. Many marginalized and enraged lone wolf murderers, thanks to easy access to assault-style weapons, can misuse Second Amendment gun rights to cleanse the world. 21st century U.S. culture still venerates violence with the U.S. myth of heroic frontier psychology, but at the very high cost of crippling and killing American children. Historian Roxanne Dunbar Oritz, in her book Loaded, A Disarming History of Second Amendment, gives alarming statistics about weapons and gun deaths in the United States of America. There are 310 million firearms in the United States, 114 million handguns, 110 million rifles, and 86 million shotguns. The number of military-style assault weapons in private hands, including AR-15 semi-automatic rifles used in the massacres at Majority Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland, Florida, and at Sandy Hook Elementary School in Newtown, Connecticut, is estimated at 1.5 million. The United States has the highest rate of gun ownership in the world, an average of 90 firearms per 100 people. The total gun deaths in the United States of America average around 37,000 a year, with two-thirds of those deaths being suicides, leaving approximately 12,000 homicides, 1,000 of those at the hands of the police. Mass shootings, ones that leave four or more people wounded or dead, now occur in the United States on average at the pace of one or more per day. Disturbing as that fact is, mass shootings currently account for only 2% of gun killings annually. And the number of gun deaths, 37,000, is roughly equal to deaths by vehicle incidents in the United States per year. The Second Amendment, written by James Madison and adopted in 1791, says a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Although generations of activists, gun owners, and jurists have disagreed about how this should be interpreted in a modernizing world, what has been recognized is what the Second Amendment was really to be used for. History professor Roxanne Dunbar Oritz documents in Loaded, A Disarming History of the Second Amendment, the purpose of armed militias of the Second Amendment. The kind of militias and gun rights of the Second Amendment had long existed in the 13 British colonies and were expected to continue fulfilling two primary roles in the new United States. Number one, destroying native communities in the armed march to possess the continent. And number two, brutally subjecting the enslaved African population. Dunbar Oritz demonstrates that the violence sanctioned by the Second Amendment was a key factor in transforming America into a militaristic business powerhouse. As the fledgling nation embarked on its relentless westward expansion in the 19th century, the labor of powerful, meanwhile, America's gun culture was growing in tandem with the country's increasingly sophisticated publishing and firearms manufacturing industries. Pulp novels romanticized ex-Confederate soldiers and rifle-wielding frontiersmen. Brand name weapons acquired a special status. In the two decades after the Civil War, Dunbar Oritz writes, the Winchester rifle was fetishized for killing Indians, and the Colt revival for outlawry. In the process, gun violence and civilian massacres were not just normalized, but commercially glorified, packaged, promoted, and mass marketed. In 21st century America, fantasy and myth about frontier psychology still continue being played out by Hollywood, video internet games, and other manufactured fantasies that promote weapon sales. Just as communities today rely on professional public health experts in epidemiology to control the incidence, distribution and control of disease in any population, so too for public safety and health, we should rely on experts in weapons control and distribution to advise and design adequate, stringent legislation for community weapons control or regulation. The profile of a gun safety program could include, number one, prior to approving access to any weapon, potential weapon owners should be required to get formal instruction and pass a rigorous background check. Number two, an annual inspection by law enforcement authorities on how ammunition and weapons are stored, plus full inspection of weapons themselves, should be conducted. Number three, banned weapons should be collected by law enforcement as well. And number four, reimbursement, if any, for banned firearms would be the responsibility of the taxpayer and should be considered an investment in public safety. After mass shootings, many have or will use an amateur or banal analysis of the psychology of killers to provide much-needed camouflage for the profiteering military gun industrial complex NRA. Declare that it is a mental health, behavioral health problem, all in the killer's mind, and perhaps we won't notice that. Pathetic U.S. state local non-controlled weapons policy results in amazingly high murder rates, suicides, and frequent mass murders. When deranged people have such remarkably easy access to arsenals of weapons, every so often one of them will go ballistic. We can't eliminate all political, religious extremism or mental illness, but we can most certainly prevent people from having access to rapid-fire semi-automatic weapons and thousands rounds of ammo. The UK has 1/6 Americans murder rate, not because they are psychologically healthier or nicer than the United States of America. The UK and many other countries just don't have or allow the weaponry hardware to be available to do as much damage. Thousands of prayers and thoughts are of little value unless Americans accept the fact that their laws reducing access to weapons need to be greatly strengthened, not loosened. Gun supporters and expedient politicians who take NRA, firearms industry, and other military-industrial complex big donor money while expressing heartfelt prayers, thoughts, and condolences for dead children, grieving parents, and disrupted communities are disingenuous, disgusting, and deserving of maximum shame for their preposterous and irresponsible scapegoating of the mentally ill, while letting politicians, devotees of loose access laws, and the profiteering gun industry itself continue to squirm out of any responsibility.
Food for thought.
Hello everyone, and here is a supplication that the faithful recite on this day, the 25th of the month of Zilqa'da, after observing a special ritual prayer and thanking God for his favor in creating the earth and the wonders it contains. O pardoner of slips, pardon my failings. O answerer of supplications, grant my supplication. O hearer of all sounds, hear my cry. Have mercy on me and overlook my misdeeds and faults, O majestic and munificent one.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
This is A to Z. An introduction into Islamic lifestyle. Today's topic, the role of faith in the life. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. No doubt that our intellect and our reason has the power to guide us in the life. We can manage our life and we can direct ourselves towards the goals which we have chosen for ourselves in the life by our help of our own reason and intellect. That is the inner guidance. That is the inner power which helps us to move towards the goals which we set for ourselves in the life. But is this enough? The intellect and the reason that helps us to move towards our own goals in the life, is that enough? And is the material aspect of life enough for us to guide to our eventual perfection? When we look at ourselves, we find that humans are not just limited to their physical being. There are aspects in our being, in our existence, which are metaphysical and supernatural. They are beyond the limits of materiality. They are beyond the limits of the known and physical world of experience. If you don't touch that aspect of your being and limit yourself just to material aspects of your life, you will eventually find that there is an inner deficiency. There is something missing in your life, not touching the dimension of spirituality and the world of immateriality eventually haunts you. And there is an inner need for touching the dead dimension of life. Welcome back. This is A to Z. We were talking about the importance of religion and faith in the life. So no doubt that there is an inner need, a psychological and internal need for touching a spiritual dimension and not just confining ourselves to material aspects of our life. How this inner need can be fulfilled? One may say that there are yogis, there are spiritual people, There are different people they claim that they have spiritual powers. When we can seek help from them to fulfill our need, but if you look at the history, of the people, the history of the mankind, you will find that the most sincere people, the most sound people in the history of humanity, the most perfect people in the history of humanity, who were very much sincere to us as human beings, were the prophet and messengers of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Their experience of spirituality, their experience of touching the dimension of immateriality, the abstract realm of reality, was the most perfect type of experience, because the result of that spiritual claim which they had, its result was the most beautiful thing. They came up with the most beautiful character, the sacrifice which they did for humanity, the most higher standards of excellence and moral qualities which they had, and the most organized and harmony which we see in their personality, brings us to the fact and reality that they were the most trustable and trustworthy people in the spiritual realm. And the gift they brought for us is the faith. A faith which is based on the rational fact, a religion which is in harmony with our own nature. So this gift is the most precious gift. Without connecting yourself, without being in connection with that realm through the religion and faith, you will not feel satisfaction in your life. May Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala bless us with sincerity and truth in paving the path of faith and religion. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Thank you very much, listeners, for listening to this episode of A to Z on IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page. To find out more about this program, log on to our website parstoday.com/EN, Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
News, social news, scientific news, artistic news. With the light.
Catching fish makes you forget even the most complex problems. But think the moment you catch the strangest one. Well, a Cambodian fisherman has caught what researchers say is the world's biggest freshwater fish ever recorded. The giant fish, which weighs around 300 kilograms and 4 meters long, was caught last week from the Mekong River. The female stingray was released back into water after being electronically tagged to allow scientists to monitor her movement and behavior. The fish was named Barami, meaning full moon in the Khmer language. An American fish biologist, Dana Lee, says the data collected from Barami can help protect the species and its habitat.
We got a call this morning at breakfast that they had caught a giant stingray here at Coprea. So we dropped everything. People came up from Phnom Penh, and we're here now just at sunset. Just tagged the giant, 330-kilogram giant stingray here in the Mekong River, and released it here right at sunset.
The stingray dethrones the former record holder, a 290-kilogram catfish found in northern Thailand in 2005. More than 1,000 species live in the Mekong River. The famous waterway originates in China and twists south through parts of Thailand, Laos, Myanmar, Cambodia, and Vietnam. Scientists have warned that plastic waste and dam threaten wildlife even in the deepest stretches of the Mekong. Geologists are rejoicing over a new discovery. A 290-million-old fossil forest has accidentally been found in southern Brazil. A team of geologists had been sent to the state of Parana to investigate the rocks there. To their surprise, they were able to find over 160 logs of lycophytes, an extinct variety of the vascular plant subgroup. It's quite rare occurrence that a large number of fossils of the plant were found preserved in upright position for such a long time. The forest itself was discovered in 2018 when a street was being constructed over there. So far, only two other similar collections have been found in smaller forest areas of Brazil and Argentina. June 21st marks the International Day of Yoga. On this day, people, especially Hindus around the world, gather in open spaces to perform this ancient physical exercise, raising awareness of its benefits on the human body and mind. Yoga is believed to have originated in India thousands of years ago and is mentioned in ancient Hindu mythological books. The word yoga derives from Sanskrit and means to join or unite, symbolizing the union of body and consciousness. In India, the day is celebrated with a different theme each year, with this year's theme being Yoga for Humanity. Mass yoga events took place around India, especially in and around iconic sites such as the Taj Mahal. Other countries, such as Vietnam and Thailand, also celebrated Yoga Day with hundreds performing it in open spaces. Agriculture is no exception when it comes to adapting new technologies in the context of changing climate. Now, French farmers in the northwestern suburbs of Paris grow greens in any season using hydroponic farms. Residents of a housing estate have ditched the traditional way of farming to create jobs for their community. Hydroponic farming is a method of growing plants in water, not in soil. It may sound like it would be a complicated process, but it's actually quite straightforward. The system is made of plastic and uses a rich organic ecosystem. The workers use less water than usual and do not even need a teaspoon of soil. One of the employees describes how they turned barren land into a farm.
It used to be a garage where they stored cars, but since there were no more cars, we used it as a dormitory. We listened to music and watched football matches. We used to meet here to have a bit of privacy and breathe, to hide away for a while. But now that it's become a place of work, I'm happy because I'm working.
Hydroponic farms can be used to grow products of all kinds in any region. In this one, farmers are planting all sorts of things, ranging from Peruvian mint to Vietnamese coriander. They hope that the system can be used to help local residents, especially those who need it the most.
The Light is a bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
The About a dozen penguins have been returned home after being given a second chance at life following their rehab in Argentina. The birds were rescued in the province of Buenos Aires and were transported to the Mundo Marino Foundation for evaluation. The Magellanic penguins were treated for malnutrition, dehydration, and parasites. The foundation's director says these pathologies are usually caused by climate change, food scarcity, and environmental pollution. Vets say they are seeing more and more of these sorts of rescues. The bears were nursed back to health in one of the foundation's facilities in the town of San Clemente del Tuyo. They were later released back to their habitat in southern Chile. People in Poland have rolled out flower carpets for the feast of Corpus Christi held in the central village of Spiszemierz. Families usually arrange colorful and symbolic carpets for the procession on the road section in front of their homes. They use flowers picked from the surrounding fields or their own gardens. They also use soil, sand, and fresh cut grass. The procession begins from the church and roams the streets of the village. The flower carpets have been rolled out annually since the tradition started 200 years ago, except for once when a storm broke out.
This tradition is 200 years old, and according to what the village elders say, it has only happened once that there was no carpet of flowers for the procession, because a storm broke out and swept everything away in the afternoon.
Families begin collecting the flowers a few days before the feast and arrange it on the celebration day. Besides its religious aspect, the event is also meant to express appreciation for nature. The practice has been passed from generation to generation ever since it began. The tradition was registered at UNESCO's cultural heritage list last year.
Artists have turned a historic village in the Tunisian island of Djerba into a vibrant open-air art museum. The organizer of the project says he has always had a clear vision for the gallery.
The goal of this project is to create a new way of displaying urban art, to create a museum, a real museum, which labels for the works with a certain lighting, certain works and staging. Also to create a dynamic to give this museum to the residents so that they could appropriate it and it almost becomes their business.
The project is called Djerbehud and it's located in a town of Eriyadh. Since 2014, about 150 artists from 35 different nations have gathered there to produce eye-catching street art. Tourists say they enjoy visiting the gallery because they can see something new every time they come round. Residents of the town are also content with the vibrant looks of their streets, saying the artwork give a little movement to their everyday lives.
Another breakthrough in the world of science. Japanese scientists move one step closer to creating lifelike robots by changing their physical appearance. Researchers at the University of Tokyo have developed living skin on a robotic finger. To that aim, they have submerged the robot's finger into a cylinder filled with a mixture of the natural skin components. The lab-grown skin is water-repellent, has wrinkles, and can heal itself. A member of the research team explains how the innovation will be helpful in the future. Let's take a listen.
As for challenges in the future, since we've only produced a simple skin, we would like to add various sensory organs such as the nervous system and the vascular system. We would like to further improve the function of the skin. Once we complete that, I believe that the skin itself could be used for transplantation, or use the skin as a model to develop cosmetics or drugs, or for leather products that do not require harming the animal, or to cover prosthetic limbs and legs.
The lab-grown skin is much weaker than the natural type. It's unable to survive long without nutrient supply and waste removal. For now, the team plans to address those issues and also include more sophisticated features. They want to add hair follicles, sweat glands, and sensory neurons to the skin. A Belgian company is trying to combat urban waste by transforming used coffee grounds into edible mushrooms that can also be used in construction. The mycelium is grown in a damp cellar in Brussels. Some 5 tons of coffee grounds are collected each month from partner cafes. They are then mixed in drums where the oyster mushroom spores are added and mixed with straw in a sack. The mushrooms emerge from slashes in the sacks 15 days afterwards and are ready to be sent to shops for sales. The business owners say they are looking to expand their business and use coffee and mushrooms as an environmentally friendly alternative to plastic.
Each day we throw away a lot of coffee, and this coffee to be produced needs a lot of energy from the cultivation to the transportation to Europe, and it's just a pity not to use it more than a few minutes to drink a coffee.
The company has already tested out its fungus-based insulating tiles and received its first order of these tiles for soundproofing purposes. Jacket says they hope to produce 12 tons of the mycelium material per month when they gather enough investment. The business owner says there is no shortage of raw material as coffee is widely consumed in Belgium. Jacket says the innovation can dramatically cut down on plastic waste.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
After more than 4 years of talks, 52 countries and the European Union on Friday, 24th of June, struck a deal to modernize the Energy Charter Treaty, a 1994 agreement that allows investors to sue governments for changes in energy policy that harm their profits. We have prepared for you an article written by Jennifer Rankin. The piece is titled, Activists Say Energy Treaty Update Fails to Address Climate Crisis. Climate activists have said a deal to update a dangerous energy treaty has failed to make the agreement compatible with the urgency of the climate crisis. After more than 4 years of talks, 52 countries and the European Union on Friday, 24th of June, struck a deal to modernize the Energy Charter Treaty, a 1994 agreement that allows investors to sue governments for changes in energy policy that harm their profits. The treaty has been described by a former whistleblower as a real threat to the landmark Paris Climate Agreement, which aims to cap global heating at 1.5 degrees Celsius, because it is feared that governments would blow their green transition budgets on compensating the owners of coal mines, oil wells, and other fossil fuel projects. Recently, 76 climate scientists told European Union leaders that even a modernized energy charter treaty would jeopardize the European Union climate neutrality target and the EU Green Deal, referring to a swathe of policy proposals launched last year to tackle the climate crisis. The compromise agreement, which was largely designed by the European Union, reduces the protection afforded to companies that have invested in oil and gas projects.